This is an interview with Ray Damore.
Correct.
At his home at 64 Laurier Street in Lewiston on April 8th, the year 2005. This is an interview for the Mill Workers Oral History Project, and this is Andrea Lungio. Could you start just by giving me your full name and spelling it?
Okay. It's Raymond, first name. G, which stands for Gerard Damore. D apostrophe A, capital A M O U R.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in Lewiston, at St. Mary's Hospital.
And the date?
January 20th, 1925, which means 80 years old.
And did you grow up in Lewiston?
Yeah, I did, yes. Lewiston, and a few years we moved to Auburn. My folks had bought an apartment building, and we lived there. In fact, I lived there until I got married, which was back in 1951. Yeah.
And so, were your parents both from Lewiston as well?
No. My mother was born in Canada at St. Hyacinth, and my father was born way up beyond the St. Lawrence, in a little town by the name of Matane, M-A-T-A-N-E, I guess this was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But when he came to the United States, like all the French Canadians at one point, he was naturalized and became an American citizen.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was soon after he got here, but that's the way it worked out. So.
Well, what brought your parents to Lewiston?
Well, like everybody else at that time, the people were coming here to work because, you know, in Canada, the farmers were getting nothing and more or less starving. And so I suppose the recruiters for the businesses in this area here were up there, you know, looking around to see who wanted to come to the United States and work. So that's the way it worked out.
Hmm.
Yeah. So.
Did your parents work in the mill?
No, that's a funny part of it. No. Fact is, no, my mother never worked. But my father was in the shoe industry all his life. So that's the way it worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what were their names?
My father was Charles Philip, and my mother was a real French, Antoinette. I don't know what her family name, but her family name was Robitaille. And so
yeah.
That's the way they came to the United States from at that point. Yeah. And but my mother was never naturalized. Mm-hmm. She had a permanent, I don't know if a permanent visa for visiting or for staying, but anyhow, it never came about. So that's the way it was.
Now, if you were born in 1925, you were a teenager at the time the Depression hit.
In 1929, yeah.
Yeah. Well, do you have recollections of that time?
I sure do. Oh, it was unbelievable things. You know, you almost fought for a penny. Mm. Or two pennies, you know, for what you thought you might work for, or, you know, any little job, anything, because there was no work, and things were, it was unbelievable. But on it, you know, people in the United States survived, you know. It's, you know, like the wars we have. We go, we come back, and we move on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a rough period. You know, it seems though it dragged on till, I would say, the mid-30s, 1930s. You know, it was a rough time. But
how did it affect your family?
Well, my father had built the home we were living in, and he built it as he had the money, So there was no debt, there was no mortgage to it. Mm-hmm. So we owned a home, and we had large gardens. Well, we had, because we had quite a lot of land. So we had a lot of gardens. So, you know, as far as food and vegetables and things like that, you know, we had our own supply. Mm-hmm. And the neighborhood we lived, further up on Main Street, the neighbors were all real nice, and those that didn't kind of shared with those that didn't. So it was a happy time when you think about it, also because of people getting together and sharing mm-hmm. things. You know, when you look back on it, you know, it was pleasant memories. It's not like, you know, you were living in some place and everybody was against you. Mm-hmm. That was in that period of time. Yeah.
Now, did you go straight from high school to work in the mills, or how did that come about?
My junior year in high school, I was drafted. And I was in the service for 3 years. I was down in the South Pacific for 3 years. And going back in time, from the time I can remember, I could pick up a pencil or a pen, and I could draw anything I could think of. Yeah. You know, I just put it on, and either on a piece of wood and burn it into the wood, or do anything.
Yeah.
So while I was in the service, I did some artwork for the military newspapers, you know, and when I got out of the service, one of our neighbors right across the street was one of the top executives with Bates. And he said, you know, I always see you with a pen or a pencil, and you seem to be able to draw anything that you think of. He said, would you think of considering of going to the Bates to draw the designs for bedspreads and draperies? I said, well, I never gave it a thought, you know, because at that time I just got out of service and I had nothing in mind. So I said, I don't know. So I said, well, think about it. So he kept, every time he'd come across the street to visit, he'd talk about it, and he says, have you thought about it? I said, well, I'm giving it some thought. He said, okay. He said, if you want, I'll make an appointment with you to your plant manager at the Bates division where the bedspreads were made. And he says, you go. And at the time, the plant manager was John Collins.
And who was the person who lived near you?
Fritz Newton. He was the head and the chief engineer for the whole mill complex. So I made an appointment. I went to see the plant manager, and of course, when you have somebody who's giving you a little bit of help, kind of nudging you, it makes a difference also. So he said, well, how about coming back and say next week sometime and bring some of your artwork, you know, whatever it is you want. Mm-hmm. So I went back the following week, and they looked at it, and he said, well, I'll bring you out to the head of the director of designing right now, which was George Mills, and he said, let him take a look at it, and you talk with him, and he said, he's expecting you. So I went out and sat down with him, and he said, yeah, he says, fact is, we have an opening right now because one of the older veteran designer has just died a couple weeks ago. And I mean, they were super designers, because the two head designers were German, and I mean they were real high tech. So it was a great area to go into, because there was one of them left of the two brothers. So I said, he said, if you want to come in, he said, we looked at all your artwork and everything. He says, you know, in your case, it'd be better to start hands on, the actual experience, than trying to go to some design school or something to get it from a book. He says, here, you're going to get the actuals. So he said, what do you want to do? So I said, well, no, I'll give it a thought. So I went back to, I guess, the plant manager, and he said, well, what do you think? I said, well, I'm interested. So he said, when do you want to start? I said, well, let's put it this way. This is the last part of October. I've been away for 3 years, and I'd like to go hunting for the whole month of November. So he said, well, that's no problem. So he said, I'll see you the first week in December. This was back in 1946. The first week in December, I showed up, and I started.
Wow.
And I just kind of fell right into it, with, you know.
So you worked very closely with the remaining German designer?
Yeah.
And who, what was his name?
Or Bill her? Lehman. Yeah. And he was as efficient and high-tech as his brother was.
Yeah.
The older one was Arthur. And, you know, if you made a mistake, you backed up and you corrected it. You didn't let it slide. I mean, mm-hmm. that's because when you're designing something, everything has to be on a graph because everything has to work out well on the loom. There's no room for mistakes. Because mm-hmm. one mistake that you make will be one mistake on the loom, which will be one bedspread that I have to throw away. So I learned from day one that you don't make, if you do make a mistake, you come back and you correct it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you ask, you know, what's the right way to correct this? And when I look back on it, I couldn't have found a better life.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was no hard work. You just sit there and you put your ideas on paper. And
so you got to create your own ideas for designs, or did it always go through the other one?
Well, the way it was way back in time, Bates was number one in the country, or in the world, as far as making bedspread at the time.
Yeah.
And all these companies were coming, like JCPenney, Sears, whatever, and back in there. And they would come to us, not their salespeople, but their marketing people, they'd come to us and they'd say, well, the trend this fall or this spring is going to be with this type of flower or this type of motif or so forth. Can you give us a bedspread with this type of idea? So whoever spoke with these people at the time made out a sketch if they were, you know, really interested. You say, how about something like this? And they look at it and say, whoa, yeah. Maybe a little bit of this, a little bit of that here and there, yeah. So before they left, you had a working idea for a commitment to them.
Yeah.
So you put this on point paper, graph paper, and you painted it out, and you showed, you know, the sort of working design. And then when you get everything processed for the cards, for the loom, and for the weaving, you send it out, and the sample weaver wove one bedspread as a trial to see, to look at it, see what you had. And if everything looked all right, you would ship that to the customer, and they looked at it. And most of the time, they, you know, you get a call a couple of days later and say, yeah, go ahead with this. And you got so many sizes of this color and so many sizes of that and so forth. So we used to run twins, doubles, queens, and kings. So, you know, they'll say, well, we start off with 50,000 units or 100,000 units. And so you get together with the accounting people in the main office, and the people who organized for production say, you got to set up so many thousand units, and this is what you're going to, here's your design and their patent, go ahead. And this would be, say, for JCPenney's or Sears or whoever else the account was. So that's the way it worked.
Were there other departments within the mill that you worked really closely with, or?
Well, yeah, the weaving department.
Yeah.
And we always had our own sample weaver. In other words, he was probably the best weaver around that we acquired just for this purpose, and that's all he did, just weave our ideas.
Oh, and then you could really see it,
yeah.
And then know whether it was something you wanted to go with.
We tell them, you know, just weave a little strip of this so we can see just this area, and bring the piece in so we can take a look at it. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it worked out. So this mm-hmm. this weaver, or this person, whoever was doing it, that's all he was doing. So if he had to weave just a little strip, say first thing in the morning, and we didn't need anything else the rest of that day, he could sit down. And sometimes we'd kind of loan him out to the weaving area so they would, in case they needed some help. But
yes,
that's the way it was set up. There was a lot of people around to do even minor things in that period of time. It wasn't like today and everything, it was a skeleton crew, and you know, this person has to do 15 other things while he's doing this. Each person had their own specialty, really. Yeah. And over the years, just the design area, we had a staff of about 12. We used to average about 12 people. In other words, we had the design core of, say, the artists or the designers as such. And we usually average, well, it was between 4 and 6 designers at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both male or female. So there was no discrimination, even back then.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember in the summertime, over the years, we'd have students come in that were interested in designing. And one of the students that came in quite a few summers, Elaine Libby from Libby Mills, you know, she would come in. We'd get a call by the time her spring college session would be coming to a close, and she'd say, "Can I come for the summer?" I said, "Oh, sure, come on in." And fact is, that's the way I got in contact with the Libby Complex over the years, and I did a lot of freelance work for the Libby Mills. So.
Yeah.
And but
were they in competition with the Bates Mill at all, or was it just very different?
No, because when you think about it, the Bates Fabrics people, we were woving cotton. We were in the cotton field for cotton bedspreads and cotton draperies and everything else. Libby Mills across the street was in the woolen area, so there was no.
Right.
And most of their patterns, their designs, was aimed at the Indian motifs and that kind of, and gradually we kind of worked them into plaids later on. We thought, well, it's time to phase away from, you know, let's get with it. Then we got them to go into the plaid area, which they did extremely well after that. Yeah. One of the things with the Libby Mills was that the week before they were going to start up a whole series of brand new looms they had bought to weave this type of plaids, which is still in the woolen area, we had just completed a whole series of designs for them. And that's when they had the big fire over there. And it burned all the new looms and everything that had just been set up. So that was the kind of downfall of Libby's. You know, they could come back after that. So, but that was excellent too. You know, freelancing with the Libby's, because Bates was aware of this because, you know, it was a kind of a neighborly thing because there was no competition, and they just said, you know, this is your free time, you can do what you want with it. So. And of course, when you're freelance, the money is real good.
So, yeah. So. Now, in your department, were there mostly Franco-Americans, or was there ethnic diversity within the design area?
No, they were all, you take Bill and Arthur Liebman, they were German.
Yeah.
They were pure. Yeah, they were from Germany originally. They were born both in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And Herbert Hecker, he was, you know, I don't know exactly what the nationality was there. And we had Canadians. Of course, like Libby was, I don't know if she was Irish or or English, and then we had George Mills and Harold Mills,
Yankee.
You know, So it was, and we had one or two Italian people at one time. So it was, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't exactly, you know, mm-hmm. one nationality.
Right.
So it was a mixture of such.
Do you know, did different ethnic groups tend to be in different certain areas of the mill, or were they you recall?
No, it's funny. The thinking wasn't like that. It was a case of, this was your qualifications, you were well suited to do this type of job, and that
right.
was it.
Right.
So it wasn't, you know, we get a whole bunch of Irish people over here, a whole French Canadians over here, and it didn't work out that way. No, it was, everybody kind of worked together. Of course, like any other place, you always get one or two people that mix up everything for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like everywhere else, you know. Over a period of time, you kind of keep an eye on him. First thing you know, it comes an opportunity, so here's your severance pay.
Were there social activities connected to the mills that people who work there got involved in?
Okay, one of the things, hockey. Bates had the championship, world championship hockey team way back in time. Rachel's got some photos there at the museum. You know, that you can check on. We had bowling leagues, we had softball leagues, we had baseball leagues, we had camping trips, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had our own newspaper that was published, I think most of the time it was on a weekly basis. And then we had monthly magazines, and we had trade magazines that we put out, I think it was like a cycle, the spring, midsummer, and the fall.
Mm.
And so.
Oh, wow. Did you belong to any of those?
I belonged to the bowling league. The fact is, I had started when the big ball bowling alleys first came, I had made contact with them. And we started a bowling league right there and then. And then it kind of built up in different divisions of the Bates complex, you know, like the Bates division, the Hill division, the Andrews Coggin, and the Edwards division. And, you know, we kind of have our own interleagues.
Yeah.
So
you got to know people who didn't necessarily work closely with every day in another, by being
right.
on those teams.
Yeah, you got to meet people from other areas of the same complex, mm-hmm. you know, the same. So,
yeah.
It, like I say, it was a great life. Mm. You know.
Did it feel like more than just a job, or how did it feel like a community in some ways?
Yeah, it did. You know, it wasn't like you say, well, I got to go to work today. You know, you say, you get up in the morning, and, you know, hey, I'm ready to go. What's going to happen today? And, in my case, every day was different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you walk in and somebody would say, you know, you got a message here. This customer or this is, you gave him an idea or you sent him an idea last year or last week, and they, you know, they're interested. Can you elaborate a little more on this idea? So, you know, I'd sit down and look, see if we had anything going. If we had a design or a project going that we needed to expedite, well, then that had to be out of the way, and then I'd come back. And
mm-hmm.
But, you know, every day was different. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You get a call from the New York office and say, hey, we're going to send somebody down there, and they want to talk to you, because, you know, you spoke to them over the phone or something a couple weeks ago or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you stayed until 19?
I retired from the Bates in 1989, okay? This is when there was a big turnover. The mills were real low as far as money. And the thought was to borrow a large sum from the government or sell out and try to keep it going, whoever's going to buy it. This is when the two Chinese brothers came in, Thomas and Eric Ting. In other words, they're more or less investors. In other words, they were backed by billions of dollars coming out of Hong Kong. And they had more money and they knew what to do with it. So they heard of this because they had acquired a mill in North Carolina by the name of Minette Mills in Grover, North Carolina. It's just about 35 miles south of Charlotte, where the airport is in North Carolina. And they came in about that time, and what they offered was to buy the shares of all the stockholders of Bates at the time. Not buy the company, buy the shares, which means the minute they bought the shares, they controlled. They didn't have to buy anything else. Acquired it that way there, that, without buying everything. They acquired the shares, which meant they had the controlling interest by about 60 or 75%, so they owned it without buying it. And I don't think they spent more than, if I can remember right, $70,000 or $75,000.
Oh my gosh.
And there's nothing you could do about it. It was legal. Just prior to that, we had become an employee-owned corporation, but it just wasn't working out. You know, we had money on loan, and we just couldn't make the payments and this, because the business at certain times of the year was like in January, the business is always real low, and other times, but then. At that point, it was almost year round. We couldn't attract much of anything, because I guess the whole market, the big companies were going from woven bedspreads to the comforters and other types of bedding. So the turnover, we just didn't fall into that area at the time, because we hadn't anticipated, because we didn't have the money to go into that development for that area at that time, so
yes.
that kind of ruined us at the time. So when these two brothers came in, it was like, you know, everybody on the upper echelon thought, oh, this is great, you know. But thinking about it, we like some of us that knew about this, we were thinking about it, saying, no, this is not really going to work out. And so anyhow, it went through. They acquired the ownership by this, you know, stock majority that they acquired.
Right.
And in the beginning, of the two, one was an older Chinese from the old type of family. You know, he believed in family and, you know, the good things. The younger one, he was a playboy. He was brought up and all that money, and he had no responsibility. He had no background. As an example, one time he went out and bought a Rolls Royce convertible. You know, Rolls Royce, bright red with tan top, you know, and never made a payment on it. The repo companies would come around and say, would you know about Mr. Tang's car? What car? You know, I said, you know, we've seen it, you know, in the beginning when he first brought it, came in with it, but we haven't seen it since, you know. So eventually, checking here and there, it was hidden in somebody's old garage behind some house. Never made a payment, but that's the way he was. He bought boats this way, sailboats. He had a nice one at Freeport, a yacht basin. Boy, you know, probably $2.5 million job.
Mm.
Never made a payment on it. But that's the type of person he was. But the older one just couldn't get him to get on the right track, you know. Because the older one in the Chinese family, the older brother is always the keeper of the younger ones. And whatever they do, you try to correct it and you try to get them on the right track. But if he doesn't want to get on the right track, there's not much you can do about it. He just has to pay, you know, the consequences and pay the debts. So that's the way those two were.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, after they took over, well, just before they took over, they came around to look, see what there was and everything else. The plant manager at the time called and says, "Hey, it was a kind of a poor way to say this, but he said, you know, the Chinks are coming in to visit today, you know," which was, I said, "Okay." And he says, "They want to go in and talk with you." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, they think you have the most interesting area of the whole complex, because this is the beginning of what it, where everything starts." Well, okay. So they show up, and the younger one, you know, just roaming around, you know, we look at this, look at that, and keep walking. But the older one, he'd stand there with you, and you could almost tell he had a list of questions this long, and he'd say, if you did this or that, because he was high tech. If you did this with this machine here, would it do this?" So I kind of look at it, and I said, "Yeah, it would." "Yeah? Okay." Then he'd move on to something else, and he'd say, "If we did that with that operation over there, could you get these results?" And he'd think about it for a few minutes and kind of figure it out. I said, "Yeah, I think we could. Yeah." So for almost every week there, for a couple of months, he would show up. He wouldn't bring the younger one. He'd show up by himself. He'd come in and he'd say, "Let's go on the other side of the sample room where it's going to be one-on-one." And he says, "Let's sit down." He says, "I got a lot of questions for you." I said, "Oh, okay." First thing I know, he says, "Wait, wait, wait." He said, "I understand you're getting ready to retire." I says, "Yeah, at the end of the year," which was 1946. I says, "In the month of December, I'm retiring." "Oh, you can't do that." "No, why not?" I had thought of this ahead of time, and I had checked with different people on the state level and so forth. I said, "There's a chance to go to consultant, instant consultant." So I says, "Oh," I says, "okay, Thomas." I says, "Talk to me." I said, "I'm going to retire in December. Either I'm going to fade away, go to somebody else," you know, that kind of caught his attention. He said, "Who else?" I said, "Well, I have friends at Fieldcrest, at Cannon Mills, West Point Pepperell, that, you know, I could easily, on a part-time basis." "Oh, no, I can't do that." He said, "Oh, how about you becoming a consultant for us, exclusively?" "Hmm." Well, I said, "Okay." He said, you get a fee?" I said, "Yeah, oh, okay, I got a fee." I says, "The fee would be so much plus expenses, and I'll give you 1 week a month. One solid week a month, and that's it, for this fee." I see the figures. And it's fine. He said, "Actually, you could have started higher if you wanted to." I said, "Well, you could do that yourself." I said, you could increase, you know, so that way there it would be kind of a mutual agreement. He said, "Well, let's give it about 6 months," and then he said, "Well." But he said, "Also, I'm going to throw in your living quarters when you come down." And he says, "You're going to have an office down at Manette Mills in North Carolina. You're going to have your own office down there." And he says, "Over here, well, you're still going to be your office in the designing department here." So I said, "Well," I said, "how about the management here?" He said, "Well, don't worry about management, because you're going to be above this management. You're going to be working for me. You're going to be my assistant. You know, you're not going to be vice president or nothing, but you're going to be over everybody. So it's, don't worry about the plant manager or vice presidency, because you're going to be over them starting." So I said, "Okay." So I did that for 7 years. I had a running account with Bonnie Adams at Lawson Travel, you know, and I call up Bonnie and say, "Okay, Tuesday morning at 6:30 out of Portland and to Charlotte, North Carolina, and a rental car at the airport." Fine. So Mm-hmm. And here's the corporate discount and the whole bit. So, so I traveled for 7 years. And the agreement also for my wife to come with me. So, and when we were down there, you see these old big southern houses, you know, with these big columns and the whole bit, two stories and the real thing. This is where we lived while we were down there. We had a chef in the kitchen. We had maids. We had cleaning people.
Wow. So you enjoyed those 7 years, I take it.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy those 7 years?
Well, when I think about it, I said, you know, why didn't I think of this about 25 years before this? You know? Oh, yeah. And the funny people would say, God, you're always traveling, and you get your briefcase, and you know, you're going here, you're going there. And I said, yeah, but keep in mind, it's a little bit stressful because you've always got a time, you've got to be at a certain place at a certain time to meet with people to discuss, you know, projects and so forth. And I said, hey, well, it's an excellent way of life, but there's a little bit of stress. But I said, oh, hey, I like it. You know, like my wife would say, oh, you're having a good time. I said, sure am. Yeah, and we'd schedule it so we'd go down there on a Tuesday, mm-hmm. and we'd stay over the weekend and come back the following Wednesday. So on the weekend, we had the rental car. The older brother had a big condominium in Nashville, North Carolina, in the mountain area of Western North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
It was, we could sleep 10 people. It was right on top of a mountain. And the keys were always there. I said, you know, if you want, you know, if you want to go spend a weekend up there, you know, here's the keys going up. And he said, you make a call first to the caretaker. We'll make sure everything is in order. So he says, the only thing is, he says, you'll have to scrounge for food on your own. I said, well, that's hard to do. So that's, yeah. All we'd hang around, we'd visit in Charlotte, which was a real money city. I mean, when you talk about Charlotte today, where all the credit cards and everything else that's processed in the world today, it's either in the Charlotte area or Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we used to drive down because this was right on Route 85 going directly to Atlanta, Georgia. You know, we were about a quarter of a mile from the interstate where the plant was and where we sang at the house, and we get on the interstate, drive directly to Atlanta and visit, you know, Peachtree and everything else in Atlanta, and stay at better hotels in Atlanta, and that was all part of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
So
how long did the Chinese brothers stay involved with the mill? Until what? Or what happened when they left?
Everything fell apart. This is when Fred LaBelle, you know Fred?
Mm-hmm.
Fred was plant manager at the Bates Division. He was about the only surviving one left at the time. He acquired financing or backing to acquire Bates Fabrics at the time. But he just didn't have enough capital to keep it going. And after he was really on the wall there, and I think this is about the time that Emil Clavette, the investor, financial investor, mm-hmm. came in and took over, and they created Maine Heritage Weavers,
mm-hmm.
because when the Chinese acquired Bates, they acquired the name Bates Fabrics. They paid $2 million just for the name of Bates Fabrics. And the minute they acquired that, they could shut everything down and go to some other part of the world and set up a little plant, which was Bates Fabrics.
Mm.
Good. And while I was the consultant for those 7 years, I came under the Manette Bates Corporation. I was the corporation. So if anybody tried to sue me for any breach or anything, they had to sue the corporation. So I was covered for any suit or anything.
Mm-hmm.
While, because on my business card it said, you know, Manette Bates, but down way down on the bottom it says Manette Bates Incorporated. and that was my, I was the corporation. So,
yeah.
But the controlling, the two Chinese, they're controlling corporation was Chauncey Corporation, which came out of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. This is where the money was moved back and forth. And I don't know if it was the younger one that was blowing the money, and it just wasn't going in the right direction. And I think in the end, because I think it was 2 years after I finally retired, because I figured I was going to, when I retired here at Bates in the Bates division, I had 43 years of time in.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept thinking, well, if I go about 7 years as a consultant, I'll have exactly 50 years, and then I'll be ready, you know. So the two Chinese brothers, the older one kept, he was never really around. He'd probably come in once a month, for sometimes it would be a week, sometimes 2-3 days, because he'd call me up, whether I was here in Lewiston or down in North Carolina. He'd call me up and say, Ray, he said, how about this, think about this. He says, can I do this? I think about it, and I said, well, if I couldn't give him an answer, I said, well, I'll call you back. I said, where are you right now? He said, I'm in Hong Kong. So I said, okay, give me about an hour, and you call me back. I'm not going through your system over there. It takes too long. He said, okay, and I'll call you back in an hour. So that's the way it was. Other times he called me and he said, where are you now? I'm in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. We had a set up in Jamaica, at the Kingston Inn in Jamaica. He said, I'm in Jamaica. He says, I've got a whole bunch of looms here. I'm thinking of getting started. He said, you're giving some thought of, you know, this project. I said, yeah. I said, it won't work. Why? How come? I explained it to him. He said, oh yeah, I never thought of that. Okay, forget it. Yeah. Goodbye. Yeah, you're gone. Next time I know, I'd be in North Carolina. Who do I come? He comes walking through the door. How you doing? No, it was like that. Every day was different, whether it was here or down in North Carolina. And if I was in North Carolina, or Baxter Corporation was a supplier for textiles, for any kind, thread, cars, or computer things. They were the supplier to the textile industry, and they were located in New Jersey and one in Shelby, North Carolina. So every so often, if they knew I was down there, they'd give me a call and say, would you come down to our plant? We got a question. We'd like to run over. And, so I said, okay, I'll drive down. Say tomorrow morning. Okay. So I drive down there, and we go to the executive boardroom and sit there for hours, and they'd order food in, and they say, well, it's about lunchtime. We'll order a meal in, and you ready to eat? I said, why not? So we'd walk around, and of course, these places here, you really weren't supposed to be in there, because everything's supposed to be top secret of what they're making, so the competition wouldn't find out. But
yeah.
They brought me in, and I could pick up anything I wanted to, and they knew that, I was up front honest with them for everything. Whether I liked it or not, I told them what I thought. Mm-hmm. Either I didn't like it, I'd say yes or no, They'd say, well, we're thinking of doing this. I said, no, it's no good. It won't work. You might get a good sample or a good starting thing, but it just won't work in the long run on a production basis. So I don't care what you do. Okay. Well, how about a different idea? I said, well, okay, I'll work on that. But that's...
Yeah. Let me stop and flip the tape for just a minute.
Okay.
We are now on side B. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Okay. So how much time you need?
Well, let me think about...
You got any more?
Hold on just a second. I guess one of the questions that I wanted to ask you was, To go back a little bit about the people who worked in all the different areas in the mill and how they interacted. I know you talked that you worked directly with the loom, the weavers.
The weaving room, yeah.
What sorts of different jobs were there in the mill?
Well, of course, we're almost self-contained as far as, in other words, the cotton would come in from the cotton fields and bales. It would start right from that point to make the yarns for the woven goods. So we processed all the way through from the cotton ball itself coming out of the bale. It was, processed different machines all the way through until it was a fine thread for weaving. So we and then after, say, the bedspread was woven, it was either pre-shrunk, if it was going to be a natural color bedspread, or if it was going to be dyed, we had our own dyeing in the lower area of the Blades complex. We had the giant vats to dye any color you could think of. We had Jerry LaFrance, who was a chemist in the lab, to give you the right color for any shade you wanted. So anything that you needed, we had. As far as maintenance, we had the electrical shop, we had carpenter shop, we had machine shop, we had plumbing shop, you name it, they could make it. If anything broke down, they could make it within a certain period of time. Unless there was a special piece of machinery on a certain part of the loom that it was a trademark, then you couldn't really make it to fit. It had to be the trademark piece to go back. But anything else, they could make right in the plant. So we were self-sufficient. And finishing the bedspreads, packaging bedspreads, until they were all completed and going out the door to be shipped to the customer, everything was done. Our office, we had all the accounting people, the business people. We had the New York office in New York at the time. The main office, we owned the building, was at 80 Worth Street. We had I don't know how many salesmen at one time, probably anywhere from 40 to 50, all over the United States, and from beginning to end, we were self-contained as a corporation.
Did people work shifts? Was the mill going all the time?
We ran three shifts, yeah, and in the good years, yeah. We had from 7 to 3, 3 to 11, then 11 to 7. Yeah, yeah, just like that.
Yeah. And now, in your department, design, they didn't work shift work there, did you?
We were in from 8 to 5.
Yeah.
Then later on, we went to 7 to 4, or 7 to 3:30. And we went out for lunch break. Most of them, they took a half an hour to cut down that time. So we went from 7 to 12, and then 12 to 1, we took a lunch break, and then we came back from 1 to 3:30 or 4. But on some periods when we were overloaded with design work, we worked a lot of overtime. I saw spells where I'd go into 7 in the morning and stay there till 5, come home for about an hour, and go back about 7 till midnight.
Now, did you get paid extra, or were you salaried?
Oh, yeah.
You did.
This was big money. Yeah.
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 And so it was probably, I'm thinking in terms of lifestyle, the people who work shifts were a little bit different in terms of how they work than, say, you, where you were pretty much during the day. Did you interact at all with the people who worked?
Well, see, like on my level, going back from day one, I kind of, when I walked in, I walked in on a management level, as far as you look at it, and not say on the union, because I never had anything to do with the union, and of course, everybody, say, starting with the weaving and all the other departments, everything was union.
Mm.
But say the main office, all the office and the accountants and everybody else, that was strictly the management area. So that way there, you know, maybe I was fortunate. I when I walked in from day one, I walked in on the management level. So that's the way it worked out. And the union over the years, they were good. You know, they weren't, you know, like some of the unions you've seen with the auto manufacturing and so forth, they get out of hand. This local union was, they did well with the people.
Were there issues that came up over the years that you can recall that the union got involved in? Hours or working conditions or pay?
Well, you know, it was the usual thing. There come a period of time where people get a little antsy. The price of things will start going up. The people say, well, it's time for a raise. Well, then the contract, over the years, average on a three-year level. The contract will run for about 3 years. And then the people, going into the beginning of the third year, say, okay, everything's going up. We need a raise, you know. Mm-hmm. So I really never saw a strike or a shutdown for, I don't know, any more than I can really remember of a week, really, over the years,
mm-hmm.
or anything serious, things nasty, like breaking things or, you know, hurting people. It never happened,
mm-hmm.
You know. The people had their opinions, and they,
mm-hmm.
but they all went to the union meetings. And this is where they vented all their displeasures and so forth. So it was fine over the years. I really can't remember any event that, you know, was serious enough to,
mm-hmm.
you know, like you'd call the police in to squash something.
Right.
I can't ever remember it, anything like that. So,
do you have recollections of Hal Goslin?
Hal Goslin, yes.
He was president or vice president of Bates at one time.
He was assistant to the president.
Assistant to the president.
That's, in the beginning he was, in the beginning, if I remember right, he came in to publish a magazine. He was in charge of publishing the magazines, mm-hmm. and the yearly annual reports and things like that. So he was involved in the printing of the magazine and so forth. And of course, we changed presidents over the years quite a few times, you know.
Yeah.
And he, at one point there, he went from that position to assistant to the president. And if I remember right, he stayed at that level until he, I don't know if he retired or moved on to, he moved on to CMMC. But I think he was just assistant to the president when he moved to that area.
Mm-hmm.
But he went to CMMC as, I think it was public relations director when he moved to that area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, I remember I used to, few contacts with Hal. we discussed some of the things in, you know, in the magazines he put together for, like the spring line, the fall line, and things like that. That, you know, I think it ought to go this way. I said, no. It's
artistic disagreements.
Yeah, just, you know, business disagreements. Yeah.
So you said there were quite a few Bates presidents over time at the mill. Are there any that really stick out in your mind as being impressive or not so?
Yeah, there was one way back in time, Herman Ruhm. He was a family man, and he was honest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some, one of them was Arnold Ginsberg. He was a character. He'd show up probably every 2 or 3 weeks and He'd walk in, come through the door, "Here I am. My name is Arnold Ginsberg. I'm president." I says, "Yeah, Arnold, this is what you said when you were here last week." I said, "Don't you remember?" "Oh, yeah, 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 okay, you know, flighty, you know." But there was
what?
My wife was a nurse till she retired, and she said, "Well, I want to do something different." So she went to work at Porches, you know, selling the kitchenware.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, if you look around, you see all these quilted things are hanging all over the place.
Oh, beautiful! Yeah,
this is her hobby. So she's got her workshop back there. I still got my office way back in the beginning, because I still do a few things on the side. So,
yeah.
But anyhow.
But were there any other Bates presidents that you recall, or are those the ones that really stick out?
Bill Hickok. He was interesting. It was Thomas Levine. He lives in Manchester. He was probably towards the end of just before the tanks came in to buy out the Bates fabrics, and but way back in time, God, there was so many I just can't.
That's okay.
Yeah, but it seems so. Every come the first of the year, we get a memo saying, "Well, the old president is either going to someplace else or he's retiring, and we're going to have a new president in a couple of weeks." So this is what the way it was. But you know, a president is like, you know, okay, they come in, they go, you know, it doesn't change anything. Everything keeps moving, unless you get one that's coming in who's got stupid ideas, you know. Like, well, when the Tangs came in, the younger one, Eric, he had all kinds of, you know, "Well, we're going to modernize this way," and I said, "You know, you're not thinking of the people, Eric." I said, "You're thinking of the machine. You got to think of the people. This machine is not going to work until these people press the button and tell it what to do." "Oh, yeah, but that's simple." I said, "No, Eric, it's not simple. You're not considering the product that you're going to use this machine for." I said, "It's just not going to work." "Oh, wait and see." You know, they bring the machine in and set it up. It'd take 3 or 4 weeks. Even the people who set it up couldn't get it to coordinate with, you know, what was supposed to be, the duty was supposed to be doing. And I'd walk down, take a look at it, and I'd sit back and laugh. And Eric would show up and he'd say, "What do you think of that thing?" I said, "Yeah, come on down, let's go take a look at it." And I'd stand there and say, "What do you think?" I said, "Stand here and watch. They're trying to get it to go." I said, can you go over there and get it to going?" And I said, "Well, I know." He says, "I'm not up on this high-tech stuff." I said, "Why the hell did you get it?" "Well, somebody sold me on the idea." I says, "Yeah, all right. You spent $75,000 setting this thing up, and you're paying it on a lease basis, on a monthly basis, and now you probably paid a couple months," which I didn't think you did, but anyhow, I said, "and it's not even running yet, and it's not going to run." He said, "Well," he says, maybe you're right." He said, we'll give it another month. Within 2 weeks, the people who brought it in came and took it out, and they went back to the...
Yeah.
But, you know, he was like that over the years, but, you know, like Bill Hickok, in his spare time, his hobby was woodwork, to make woodwork, outdoor chairs for lawn furniture and things like that. And he lived in upper New York State, and he has his own workshop. And and every time he'd come to the plant, he'd say to us, "Can you draw me an idea for this type of chair or this type of cabinet?" I says, "Hey, we're making bedspreads here, you know, not furniture." "Well," he says, "you know, this is for my little project." Okay, so we kind of scribble an idea. "Hey, yeah," he says, "I," he says, could you detail it a little bit, so, you know, to show me the parts? So I said, yeah, I think so. I said, next time you come, we'll give you a blueprint of some kind. Because we could do blueprints too, so. Because I had taken mechanical designing and blueprinting and the whole bit, so that there was no problem. Fact is, our design department, we could do anything. The artists in there could paint, you know, they could pick up, you know, you come in, and they could just look at you and paint a portrait, sketch it out within half an hour, and then go home and make a painting and come back next week.
Yes.
Yeah. And I had one guy, Larry Stevens, he was unbelievable. He could paint the best portraits, and this type of people we had.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Are there things that I haven't asked you about your time at the mills that you think is really important to add today?
Okay. Let's go back a little bit. Over the years, it was Bates Manufacturing way back in time. That's the way it was, Incorporated. Bates Manufacturing Company, Incorporated, I think it's the way it was way back in time. We had the Androscoggin division, which was where Marden says there was a storehouse way down north the end of Elizabeth Street. And then we had the Hill division. The Androscoggin was where the main offices used to be way back in time. And then they were brought back to the Bates division later on. Then the Hill division was weaving mostly sheet goods. And I think at one time they wove a shirting material. Way back in time, they used to have these striped shirts, which was a big trend way back in time, in the 30s, 40s, and that period. And of course, the Bates division always wove bedspreads. But way back in time, they wove rayon bedspreads. then later on, we went to the nylon, Dacrons, as far as yarns. And then we wove table covers with napkins. I don't know if you remember seeing those way back in time. The nice shiny table covers that we used to weave with napkins and the whole bit as a set. Then later on, we got together with Guilford Mills out of Dexter.
Mm-hmm.
The period of time when the office complex, in other words, they put up an office building and it was wide open. And instead of having all kinds of office divisions, they came up with the idea of walls in between each area. No, in other words, you have this area here, and we're going to put up a wall here. But it wasn't a full wall. It was just, say, a panel. And all these panels on both sides needed something to give it some color. So we wove what we call paneling material. Mm-hmm. It was woven by the yard, and we put all kinds of designs on it. And this was cemented to these panels for divisions in big office complex. Like, you know, if you see a commercial today, you see all these little cubby holes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of them these days, they're all plain, you know, they have it shabby looking. Well, what we did is all kinds of designs on each one of these panels. Say you had an office, you could have one panel like this, or with one design over here, one over here, and so forth, if the management wanted to pay for this kind of paneling. So we worked, and then at about the same period of time, we worked with this company or this people out of New York that they were in that same field, and that they were making this type of for hole walls, you
mm-hmm.
know, and we did a lot of that, and we used to for them we'd take a warp beam. You know, with all you've seen, probably with the yarn that's laid on, so we could set it up on the back of the loom
mm-hmm.
for the warp yarn. Well, we did multicolors. We'd put it all on there, and we'd run it through, and we had a design that when the colors were dyed onto this warp, It was silk just yarn, but it was dyed onto this warp. It gives you all kinds of designs. And then when they put the warp on the back of the loom, when it came through for weaving, you had that design on the warp itself, besides the other pattern that you put on it. So you had a multiple idea of shades on the warp itself, and then the design that you put on the face of it. And we had a monstrous order just about the time the mill kind of folded with this company out of New York. You know, we're talking, you know, millions, almost billions of dollars in contract. We just couldn't turn it over. You know, the money there, the capital for doing this, just didn't work out. And like I said, the last management there was Tom Levine who used to be with his father at Carlton Mills. You know, when you go through Winthrop, the Carlton Mills, he was there with his father. They owned that. Then when they closed down, he came to with us. But he was the last until the Tangs took over. So.
Is that a good place to stop today?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time.
You can call me anytime you want.
Okay.
You can either come here or I got...